Hey, this is Jack Russell from Jack Russell's Great White, and you listen to Focus on Metal. Ha ha.
Hey, Metalhead, Scott here.
I'm Richie.
And, oh my God, it's another episode of Focus on Metal. It's been
a while, which we say every episode now.
Well, yeah, because every episode, it's been a while.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I mean, shit's coming up and, you know, just that's what goes on. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, hey, we're back and it's another discussion episode.
Yep. I figure we should, you know, we're a bit late to the party here.
Yeah.
Because a lot of other shows have talked about this. But I think we should spend a bit of time talking about Jack Russell passing away.
Sure. Former Focus on Metal guest, Jack Russell.
Yeah.
Yet another ID that we feel weird about using. An ever-growing catalog of them.
Yeah. It's, God, if I look through the amount of people who've interviewed now.
Yeah.
The amount of people that have passed away that we've talked to.
Uh-huh.
There's a few on it now.
Yeah, quite a few.
Yeah.
Quite a few. You go back and it's like, geez, yeah. I mean, if you remember for a while, there was almost that thing where we would talk to somebody and about a month later they would die. We were on a whole run of those.
It was kind
of
like,
don't freaking talk to anybody.
Don't talk to Rich, even Focus on Metal. You're going to croak.
I think after Chris Sangaritis, we were like, holy crap, what are we doing?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
When did Great White come on your radar?
Actually pretty early on. Yeah, it was, might have even been right before they did like had their first hits and shit. Cause I remember seeing them at the casino, Hampton Beach.
Okay. You talking Shot in the Dark or their debut album?
Yeah, it would have been like around the debut.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were they headlining in Hampton? They wouldn't have been, would they?
I can't remember who else was on the bill. There was somebody else on the bill too. But I don't think they were headlining though. We sat like side stage with Mark's tech.
So, okay.
But yeah, it was early days.
Early days.
Yeah.
Yeah, they came on my radar. It was Once Bitten.
Okay.
Because they weren't really getting that much coverage in the general press and on the radio, and mm-hmm. Kerrang started covering them, and then Once Bitten got released, there was two different versions, which I spoke to Mark and Michael Lardy about in two separate interviews. So the Once Bitten record that came out in the US is the 9 song, the regular one.
Yeah,
and Alan Niven had this brain fart to put 5 songs from Once Bitten.
Oh, yeah, that's
and
right.
Then, and then put that's 3 right. songs from yeah. Shot in the Dark and call it Once Bitten in Europe.
Uh-huh.
And I remember they were playing the video for Save Your Love and I was taking out the album. This isn't on this. And eventually I got the US version.
Yeah.
But that's really when they came on my radar. And Jack as a singer...
Mm-hmm.
He always stood out to me. He was a really, really good singer and vocalist.
Yeah.
The band's sound, very blues influenced.
Oh, yeah.
They went with the image of the time,
right,
which was the big hair and everything else.
Right.
But, you know, they could play. They're a great singer. They wrote great songs. Mark Kendall was a fantastic guitar player.
Still is, yeah.
And... they just stood out because of that.
Mm-hmm.
They had a great manager in Alan Niven. They never had a Bob Rock or a Bruce Fairburn or any of these guys come in
right.
As a producer. So they kept everything in-house.
Yeah.
And they were able to make it work for a while at least.
Too, with a lot of their stuff. Let's take Save Your Love for an example, right? That would have been probably decimated and turned into crap if you put standard 80s production on it with like tons of gang vocals and reverb like crazy and like all the other things that would typically get done at that time period, it would have screwed it up. It would have lost any of the like the power or any of that stuff would have just disappeared if they had done that. So I think it worked well that they didn't have like a big producer. Plus, if you think about it, like if you get like a Bob Rock, he's very clinical. And so, yeah, it worked okay when he did like Highway to Hell. Oh, no, that was Mutt Lang. Similar thing. But the way that Bob would like, same thing with Mutt, get very clinical about it, pick things apart, try to make everything like perfect and quantized and all that. And you really can't do that with like a bluesy player like that. I think the feel of their live stuff carried through on the albums too. And I think part of why people liked it is that not that they had to play exactly the album, but it had that same kind of feel, whether you saw them live or you listened to the record.
Mm, yeah. It wasn't overproduced. Yeah. And I think Alan Niven had a lot to do with that because not only was he the manager, in a lot of ways he was writing songs with them.
Yeah.
He was the one that said, I want you to cover this song and I want you to cover that song. He picked these obscure songs over here. He picked these songs from the UK.
Yeah.
And said, right, no, not many people know these songs over here. Let's cover them.
Yeah.
And one of them was Once Bitten, Twice Shy.
Yeah.
And which I actually knew before they covered it, but for the majority of people over here, they'd never heard it before.
Right.
I think maybe Alan tried to do similarly what Quite Right did with the Slade stuff.
Maybe, yeah.
And it worked.
Yeah.
Because that song, I think, was probably their biggest hit. It was their biggest album, anyway. I think the Twice Shy record.
I mean, Rock Me was up there, too, as far as a hit. So, I'd probably have to look at the numbers to see, but definitely Rock Me was up there, too.
Yeah, yeah. But I think...
And they had minor stuff with, like, you know, Lady Red Light, things like that. But, yeah, I think those were the two big ones. I remember we covered Once Bitten. I don't remember if we covered Rock Me. We might have.
Okay. But, of course, then the band did what a lot of the other 80s bands didn't do. They kept going.
Yeah.
In the 90s.
Yeah.
Now, people came and went, but, and again, I would say to me personally that they released their best album in the 90s. I think Psycho City is their best record. I think that was 93. And they kept releasing records after that.
Now, yep.
And then people came and went, and eventually they went away for a while and came back in, you know, different reincarnations. But for the most part, it was always Jack, Mark.
Yeah.
And whoever else was in and out of the band at the time. But, you know, and then, of course, Jack in, you know, more recent times, he released that solo record. And then you had, you know, the fight with Mark Kendall over the name and, you know, and then his recent health issues, which were with everyone has cell phones now.
Yeah.
He could always sing,
yep.
But he had physical issues. You know, he'd fallen on stage.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he of course he was walking with a cane for a while. You know, what was he, 63 or 64, I think, when he passed away.
Yeah, it was, and I mean, you know, you had kind of that lead up and stuff too, but I always thought it was still kind of sudden in the fact that, you know, he did make the announcement of like, okay, well, I can't tour anymore. And it just seemed like overnight it was like, holy shit, he's dead.
Yeah. I've read his book.
Mm.
It does seem like that he announced his retirement from touring. Here's something I don't think you know. The day he announced he wasn't touring anymore, I was scheduled to interview Tony Montana, and I couldn't do it.
Oh, wow.
I had to say, I just couldn't do it. Something came up, and I couldn't do it. And I'm kind of kicking myself now because of it, because, you know, I think the people in the inner circle, they obviously knew what was going on.
Yeah.
You know, they announced that he's not going to tour, but you're not going to get any more information about really what is going on.
Yeah. And they don't really have to tell you.
No, they don't.
There's no shit to anybody.
But up until he stopped touring, he still sounded great as a singer.
Yeah.
He never lost his voice, even with all the abuse that he's given himself over the years, like with drugs and drink and everything else, and it's all in the book.
Yeah. And he's the thing too, though, is that he never did, you know, what like Don Dokken kicks himself over and what Joe Elliott kicks himself over, and, you know, which is the why the hell did I sing it like that thing, you know. He was always kind of within his range, which I think saved him, because he didn't really have to, you know, try to step up that thing later on. It was just naturally what he could hit. He didn't have to force it.
Mm. Now, I knew the book was coming out, but I don't know.
So did it go back to like his like early days, like pre-band?
Oh,
or
everything.
Like just getting in the band?
Everything.
And, so it went through like all of the larceny and all the other
crazy
shit.
Yeah, all about shooting someone getting off lightly. It's all in it. Mm. It details all of that.
Because I know that, I want to say maybe 6 months ago or so, there was a thing with Audie who they were asking him some stuff. And he was going through like all this, like, oh, you wouldn't believe like the shit that used to happen. So I was like, wow.
Yeah, there's some wild stories in it, all right. But the book came out really quickly after he died, from my recollection.
Yeah, but I know
it's like it was rushed out.
The person who was helping him with the book had been pretty regular on, hey, we're working on this. It's coming along great. So it was like you knew that it was coming out. Now, it may have been that at a certain point it got to and probably some health things that, you know, we don't know about. It might have gotten to oh, shit, we really got to, like, get this.
Yeah, we got to get it out. That's just the impression I got.
Yeah.
And it's completely understandable why they did it.
Mm-hmm.
The book itself is well written. When I originally looked at it, it's filled in the back with a lot of interviews from other musicians and friends and stuff like that. So I thought the actual story itself was going to be a lot longer and more.
Mm.
But the actual autobiography part is probably just over 200 pages.
Really?
Mm. Yeah. There's a lot in it, though.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that the intention was that they were going to do kind of like what you see sometimes? Like I just finished the Fast Eddie one that came in the Fast Eddie box set. And there's like the narrative of him, but then you have like little interview things and people commenting, and maybe the intent was to meld all of that throughout the book.
But it's not melded. All the interviews are
No, what I'm saying, maybe that
back.
Was the intent.
Yeah, I'm sure it was.
And they decided, oh crap, we got to get this out.
You make a good point there. I think that what the author did, or maybe the book publishers did, was, right, show me all the interviews you did to talk about Jack with all these other people, and we'll just put them at the end of the book.
Mm.
But you're going to put bits of course, what they said as the narrative of his story as well.
Mm.
I know Robin McCauley is one of the guys. Mm. In there,
another person
Don Dokken
hasn't lost his voice.
Yeah,
at
Don Dokken, Jack credits Don a lot.
Yeah,
with him actually having a career, because of what Don did early on in his career, getting him with Michael Wagner, and, you know, just being a friend.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think off the top of my head who else is interviewed in the back. I can't think of who else it is, but there's a lot of interviews in the back of the book.
It's kind of a weird format.
Yeah, it is, but I haven't even read all the interviews in the back. I just wanted to read the book.
That's what I mean, is like I would typically buy a book because and it's an auto, you know, it's a biography, and it's that's what I want to read about is I want to read the narrative, the life narrative. And then I would kind of, it would be kind of a, oh shit, there's like all this other stuff at the end, but I don't want to read interviews.
Yeah. So of course, a lot of people are probably going to wonder, what does he say about the nightclub fire?
Yeah.
And there is a chapter on that.
Hmm.
But these are the first things that Jack says in the book, the very beginning.
Uh-huh.
So a brief word from Jack Russell. I'm sorry for the empty seat at your table and that there's one less person to pass around a basket of warm bread. I'm sorry for the holidays, now spent in remembrance instead of celebration, aching for the way it used to be when they were here. I'm sorry for every gentle embrace of love no longer possible and that you dread every 20th of February for more reasons than ice and snow. That birthdays and sunsets and good news are things you cannot share. That plans and dreams were not fulfilled. That hell walks with you. I'm sorry that it wasn't me.
Mm.
Right, that's the very first thing he says in the book. Yeah, there's a chapter on the fire.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I was pretty big around here, and that's. Yeah, I played that club. It was not a big club, and there were people that I know that either had family injured or killed in that.
Yeah. So the chapter, there's a lot, I think what a lot of people don't realize is that there's a lot of blame for that.
Mm-hmm.
And he owns it, but he also spells it out in the chapter that, look, you had the club owners and you had the fire marshals that signed off on this stuff and, you know, their pyro guy and other bands had used pyro there and, you know, there were shortcuts taken. And I'd urge anybody, if they really wanted to know about what happened in total, mm-hmm, for all of that, it's a great book called Killer Show. I think the author is John Barilick. He was one of the defense attorneys.
Yeah.
And it's not an easy read. It is incredibly detailed, as all lawyers' books are. But when you read it, I'm not going to say you're going to say, it wasn't Jack's fault,
mm-hmm,
but there's a lot of people involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, his name was on the banner, and people are going to, you know, it's his fault.
Yeah.
But he's had to live with that. And I don't know how you live with that for so long without, you know, losing your mind, really. Because I know he had substance abuse issues beforehand, but how can that not drive you over the edge and just, you know, lose it?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, how do you live with that? Like I've interviewed the great white guys, right?
And yeah.
I think what a lot of people out there don't realize is that, you know, they'll associate Great White now. And the only guy that was actually at the venue that night was Mark Kendall. The other guys weren't even in the band.
Right.
Right. So whenever I get to interview any of them in the press release, I'm always told that I can't ask about the fire, as, you know, I just can't.
Yeah.
Which I wasn't going to do anyway. But, you know, they want, you know, out of respect for everybody, they don't want to ask you about it.
Yeah.
You know, or they don't want you to ask about it. And so that's up front. Every, mm-hmm, single, I've interviewed Michael and Audie, who weren't even in the band.
Yeah.
And I've interviewed Mark twice.
Yeah.
And I've never brought it up. Right. I know other people have. I don't know what happens to them after they do it, but and the thing is, when I've interviewed the guys, I never say it off the record. I'm not going to ask you about it. I just don't.
Yeah.
But even with Jack, when we interviewed him once, I didn't want to bring it up.
No.
I'm sure people probably want to ask him about it, but what's he going to say?
Right. I mean, I'm sure they don't want to talk about it. And two, I'm sure there's a shitload of legalities behind that too.
I'm glad you brought that up, because there's a lot of that in the chapter on the fire, that Jack says that he was not allowed to show how he's feelings, because that would, to met some people, they'd say that's an admission that it was your fault. And he said that busted him up big time. Because, you know, he was, you know, in dying inside because of this. You know, he was in shock. For years afterwards. And then he went down, you know, the drugs and the drink and all that. And eventually, you know, it all caught up with him. But, you know, there's a chapter on that. You're probably interested to know who does he call a wanker and who he doesn't. There's a little bit of that. Actually, when it comes to the band, there's a chapter on Mark. I think in the book he calls Mark at one stage his mortal enemy. That these two guys went from being joined at the hip to just not being able to, you know, be in the same state, more or less, you know, that it was like...
Well, I'm sure, you combine success and ample amounts of cocaine and, you're going to have some quick mortal enemies. So, I can see that.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that, you know, started all that was when Mark got sober and he didn't. He says Mark was okay for a bit with him having a beer or two, and then eventually he wasn't.
I mean, it's. I mean, I just know even from, like, it was a great drummer I was working with. Absolutely, like, we got along really well, and then he just was all practice shows. He would just keep doing hits of coke constantly. And it got to the point where, like, you can't even be at the same level with them. You start getting annoyed. It's like, what, you know, and that just slowly builds. And by the time we let him go out of the band, I really couldn't even speak to him anymore. It was just, and it sucked. But, and that didn't have any, like, there wasn't like money involved there or anything like that. That was just like a personal relationship within a band. And just, you know, being on that, you know, you got the other classic example, right? Which is Lemmy and Hawkwind, right? They're all dope and he's speed. And eventually that shit didn't work anymore.
So who else he has things to say about is, he doesn't really go after Michael Lardy that much. Couple of funny stories in there with Michael, but Audie, he has a couple of things to say now about Audie. I think he said Audie didn't turn up for, I think it was either his mother or his father's funeral. Basically says, Audie, fuck you. he said he couldn't play on one of the records because he was so fucked up on drugs that he had to get in a session drummer. So I think the issue he has there is that, you know, there's a lot of finger pointing and there's not a lot of looking in the mirror with some of these guys over the years. That, you know, you can say what you want about me, but you're doing the same shit I'm doing. Maybe not the same drug, but you're also have your moments out of control.
Which you hear a lot.
So, very good read. Highly recommended. I tell you, it was weird reading it, though, just after he died.
I bet.
You know? and, of course, has the author done any press?
She's done that, and she's been off of the press thing for a bit now. But, she initially did do a bunch.
Okay. All right. That must be awkward. You're talking about somebody you just wrote a book with in the past tense.
Sure, and that may also be why now, like on social media, you basically, it isn't even mentioned at all. It's now you get pictures of food and stuff. It's like she's just flipped over, and it could be that it got to be like emotionally too much.
And because
she needed to just back away for a while.
Because it has to be awkward because they're going to ask all the questions about Jack to her. Because they can't ask him. And they're going to try and get the answers that they want from somebody who sat across from him. And they might have even talked about that. And then there might be some speculation involved. And then, you know, the news sites are going to run with that. And it's like, or, you know, oh, I didn't mean it like that. And you got to be respectful as well of, he just died.
Yeah.
Awkward timing to mm-hmm. be doing interviews. And, you know, my heart goes out to her doing them, because there's obviously a relationship there. One of the things that she says in the book is that there was a lot of conversations over a long period of time.
Yeah.
This wasn't like one of these, I'm going to sit down with you for 4 hours here and 4 hours there, and then I'm going to write the book.
And from what I understand, they were like stops and starts.
Yes, there was.
Yeah.
But she obviously got to know him really well. You know, not just the great white Jack Russell, but as a person.
Yeah.
And she got it down in the book very well, that it sounds like Jack talking and not her just writing a story about him.
Well, yeah, people that ghostwrite, they get very good at that.
So, yeah. So it's well done about that on that level. But the other interesting thing is that about a week or 2 weeks after he died, I saw Great White.
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually never seen the band play, ever. I just never got the opportunity. I think they played in Dublin on the Slided In tour with Whitesnake and then never came back. And of course, in the 80s, they were playing in England, in the UK, never played Ireland. And then in the 90s, you know, they weren't over here at all. They weren't in Europe that much at all.
Right.
And I don't think that, I can't remember the last time some of these bands even played in Europe, that they all do the fly-in dates here now and that's all they do. But I was able to get backstage with my son, because I had once bitten, Jack signed it and Tony signed it.
Oh, cool.
Actually I sent it to Tony and Tony got Jack to sign it. I was only sending it to Tony. So thanks, Tony. So I was able to get Audie and Michael and Mark to sign it. So I know Lauren Black played on the record, but Tony was the guy that's in the videos and he did the tour.
Yeah.
So as far as I'm concerned, it's a fully signed album.
I get this. I'm laughing because I got that vision of the whole Quiet Riot thing with Chuck asking the kid, you want me to sign that? And the kid's like, no.
So I got brought backstage. Michael came up, said hello, walked past me, which is fine. Mark and Audie came out. I spoke to Mark for about a minute or two.
Mm.
Very nice. Audie hung around for a minute or two. Very nice.
Yeah.
Brett Carlisle, the new singer, was in the room, and Scott Snyder, the bass player. But I didn't get a chance to really talk to them because it was before the show, and I don't want to fuck around with their routine.
Yep.
So I even said to the road manager, you know, I'm only going to be in here for 5 minutes. I just want to get this thing signed and out.
Yeah.
And they were gracious. He did it. Thanked them. And I have to say that the band with Brett Carlisle are really good. Mark, still a great player.
Yeah.
They had a really good set list. They opened with Desert Moon from Hooked. They played Stick It. Yeah, they played a couple of really old tracks.
Yeah.
And then they played all the hits.
Wow, that's kind of what everyone expects.
Rock Me was fantastic.
Yeah.
That really is a fantastic song.
Oh, yeah.
The way it builds and builds and builds. It's probably my favorite Great White track. They only did one song off Psycho City. They did Big Goodbye, which I was like, ah, fuck. But it came out.
The best known.
Yeah, but
it came out
in '93, and you know they played Lady Red Light. They played three or four songs from Once Bitten.
Yeah,
like four or five songs from Twice Shy. They played the Angel song. They played, what else is on that record? Mr. Bone, which is excellent. Oh God, what else is on that? The Once Bitten, Twice Shy, of course.
Yeah.
I don't think they did that enough Hooked.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they got enough material.
Oh, Desert Moon's on Hooked.
That they can do, you know, kind of like a Tesla. They can cherry pick and still make a really good, well-rounded set, you know?
But Brett Carlisle as a singer, excellent. Just really suited the song.
Well, they don't have, again, they don't have anything that's like screechingly high. And so if you get the right person with the, you know, that right range, they can fit in pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. So I think they're like a lot of bands, you know, they're a nostalgia band for, you know, like a lot of bands now from the 80s. You know, they go young when it comes to the singer. Because the singer can probably still have the range that they need that a 60-odd-year-old singer might not have. And you see it with a lot of the bands now that do it. And I don't blame him for doing it, because people want to hear the songs. They want to hear them sung and played in the way that they remember them. So if you have a singer that can't do that and the rest of the guys can still play it, it's the singer that's going to be pointed at and said, look, you can't do it anymore. So they just reboot, put them on salary, probably pay them half or one, you know, or a third of what the of what the original singer got, and he sounds great, and people don't give a shit.
Yeah, a lot of times, they sometimes don't even freaking know. To be honest, right? I mean, like when we went to see Foreigner that time at the casino, how many people around us had no freaking clue that there was nobody up there that was from the original band? You know?
So what do you think his legacy will be? What will he be remembered by? Will it be the fire?
I don't think so.
I think for the general public, if you mention Great White, it's the fire.
Around here, it's a little more of a sensitive thing.
Yes.
You know what I mean? When you talk about somebody in, you know, Iowa... No, it's, I think what they really get remembered for is for the music.
You think so?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. Well, I hope so, because they had some great records, even some of the records they did in the 90s. And even after that, like that Can't Get Away From Here record that they did on Kalodner's label Portrait. Yeah. I think it was Jack Blades produced that. That's a great album.
Yeah.
And even Jack Russell said in the book, that's one of his favorite Great White records.
Because even if you think about it, right, like The Who, and I can't even remember which, this is probably a perfect example, I can't even remember which city it was that had the people get trampled because it was festival seating. I can't remember which show it was.
Oh, shit.
Yep, the mind is seriously starting to go. I knew it was a C city, I just... For some reason, I'm like, it can't be Cleveland, and I screwed myself all up. But that was back in 1979 at Cincinnati's Riverfront Coliseum, where 11 people got stampeded to death in the rush for festival seating at the December 3rd appearance by The Who. I remember lots of news stories about that one back in the day. Can even remember my parents getting all amped about that and thinking, you know, that was going to be the end of my concert-going days. But as we know, just kept right on going to them regardless.
But I'm sure if you were from that area and people mentioned The Who, you think of that. And here, you don't. You think about whatever, you know, music. You don't think about that.
I'm living for 13 years. I'm living here now, and I've been around a lot of places. I've never once seen anyone wearing a Great White shirt. Never. I've seen every other, not every other band shirt, but I've seen a lot of different band shirts.
Yeah. Well, you don't see. I don't think you see a lot of shirts in general now, or the ones you do see, they're bought at, like, you know, Charlotte Russe and like all these other stores that just have like these retro concert shirts, you know what I mean? And
yeah,
people that just go, oh, that's the, I like that, that shirt looks cool, they don't even have any idea who the band is, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but I'm just wondering, is it just a thing here that people for a while anyway, they, I'm not going to wear the shirt of that band.
I don't know.
Because of their association. I think so.
I mean, Nikki wears hers occasionally.
She has a Great White shirt?
Yeah, she does.
Okay. Yeah. Me personally, I've never seen anyone wear it.
Yeah.
The first time I'd seen someone wearing it was at the gig.
Hmm.
But that was at the gig.
Yeah.
It wasn't just out at the mall or somewhere like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think even in general, I mean, it used to be that, like, that was almost a uniform all the time. I lived in concert shirts.
I have a shit ton of.
But you don't really see it as much anymore. You just don't.
Yeah, my son is starting to wear all mine.
Nice.
Yeah, he's gone into school, and when the teachers came up to him and said, "Where'd you get that moving picture shirt?" "Oh, that's my dad's." And he's worn the Black Star Riders one, and when the kids said, "Who are they?" "They're a band my dad likes." Mm. Never heard of them.
Mm. Yeah, well, it's kind of typical. Yeah. You know, since I mentioned Tesla too, and we can almost be reasonably current with this episode, did you hear that they announced that they were going to put out a new EP in November?
I did, with two new songs?
So,
please tell me Phil Collins didn't produce it.
This is what drives me crazy, is they've got the one song that this is based around, and I can't even remember the title of it, which is freaking horrible. And I think they're doing like four versions of that song, and then two other surprise new songs. And Brian was asked, "Are you going to put Cold Blue Steel on there? Are you going to put the other song that you released a few years back on there?" And it was no. If you're going to put an EP out, and people would love to have a physical version of that.
Time to Rock is the other one.
I think so, yeah. Then why not, like, throw them on?
And
why are you doing four versions of one song? Okay, you really like it right now, but why are you doing four versions of that? Two surprise new ones you're not telling us about. But people want those other songs. Like, Cold Blue Steel is freaking awesome live. I love it. And when they kick into that, unlike a lot of bands now that will play something new and everyone's like, "Oh, what's this?" Everybody knows it. And like, why would you not?
Here's the thing that used to really fucking annoy me years ago. So when I'm in the 80s up to the early 90s, when bands released singles, they'd release 12-inch singles, right?
Yeah.
I used to look for the live track or maybe the unreleased studio track. The one thing I didn't want to see was the fucking extended version, the disco mix.
Uh-huh.
And this fucking sounds like this is what Tesla is doing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, nobody fucking, well, people will buy it, but I don't want it. I don't want to hear, what are you going to do, a piano version and a fucking acoustic version and an instrumental version? And
yeah, I just don't get it. If you're going to do the EP, okay, maybe you, if you really like this song, and granted, it's your band, that's great. Okay, you worked up four versions. Pick your favorite two and then put the other stuff on there. Like, even if it isn't a full album, that's fine. But at least, like, give the fans what they want instead of just being, you can only have it digital.
And they own the stuff, correct?
Yes.
Because they're self-managed, so yeah. It's all on their own label. Yeah.
You know, and he was saying something about, well, you know, we're getting old and this is tedious and it's going to take us, you know, so much longer if we have to go and record some other stuff. And it's not like you have to write it. And it sounds freaking awesome live. Fine. Go in as a live band and just knock it out. Do a couple of overdubs. People are going to go, this is awesome, because this is what you expect from Tesla.
How many live albums recently have they brought out? There's a couple,
yeah.
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 So they're able to do that.
Yeah. But yeah, I was actually surprised, because I was looking today, like, this thing, like, even available yet? What's going to be on it? And I looked
did you
up.
Did you say it's digital only?
When if you like want Cold Blue Steel or Time to Rock, it's digital only.
Oh.
There are no physical copies of those songs.
Makes no sense at this day and age.
Yeah. But yeah, I looked and I was like, okay, because, you know, like, that's the last one they put out live.
Okay.
And then you look and then I was like, when the hell did all those live albums come out? Between what was it, Shock and this, I was like, what the hell? Yeah, it was all kinds of crap. I was like, yeah, it just drove me crazy. I don't know. Anyways. Talk about some better stuff, people dying and shit. I posted a bunch of pictures a few weeks back
was able to go down to down to Boston and see Accept and KK's Priest. Fucking awesome show. Awesome show. Accept knocked it out. It was cool what they did, and it sounded really good. And that looking at what they had on stage is, I don't believe they used any actual amps during the show. They had everything modeled. Because you look down at the stage, and although Wolf had a pedal board, but everybody had iPads with controllers on them. And I was like, and I'm thinking, you know, if you're doing like these small theater runs and you want to keep costs low, that is not a bad way to do it. Because some of the modeled stuff now, you crank that up and people wouldn't know the difference. And I think they were using all modeled stuff. It sounded fantastic. And, well, you know, what was weird was it was a weird crowd. Even Nikki was like, this is a very interesting crowd here.
Did both bands play, 70 minutes, or did they play 90?
Except had a shorter set. I don't remember how long KK was, but theirs was longer.
So how many songs from the Mark Tornillo era did Accept play?
With a quite shorter a bit. Set? And that's what I was saying, is that they did, like, what was interesting is, when they were playing some of the stuff off of, so like Teutonic Terror, right? Everybody was like losing their minds, singing along. Everybody knew it. And they played Fast as a Shark. And I was like, oh yeah. And I look around and there were people like, huh? It was, what is going on here? Fortunately, everybody knew Balls to the Wall. That was okay. But it was, and I mean, I was enthused that people knew some of the newer stuff. That was great. It was just interesting that how few people were as enthused about Fast as a Shark. I'm thinking, like, this is like the birth of speed metal right here with this song. And there were some of the older people there that were, especially some of the people right up front, that were like, yeah. And it wasn't a matter of Mark's enthusiasm, because he sang with the same enthusiasm whether he was doing Udo stuff or his stuff. It didn't matter. He was still putting the same effort in.
So did they do Metal Heart?
I don't remember everything they did.
Okay, Midnight Mover.
Yeah, it's kind of a, like, blur.
Okay. So do you reckon it was, what, 50% Mark era and 50%
something
classic?
Something like that, yeah.
That's for, these days, that's, with a replacement singer, that's a pretty good ratio.
Yeah. 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 And then of course, KK and Ripper, they were fantastic.
I've always been a Ripper Owens fan.
Yeah.
Interviewed him once years ago.
Yeah, he came out. He was super dynamic. He was spot on.
He's a great singer.
Yeah, and everybody was like behind him. There wasn't any like, you know, you're not Rob. Everybody was super psyched that it was almost equal of seeing Ripper as it was seeing KK for most people there, I think.
Really?
Yeah, it was. They were like very supportive, and yeah, he was in awesome, awesome vocal form. Yeah,
excellent.
Yeah, it was really, really good.
That's good to know.
Yeah,
I'm a much bigger fan of the second record than I am of the first one.
Hmm.
I found the first one some good moments on it, very cliche, and yet does the second one have a some cliche on it? Of course it does. I think when you go into Blabbermouth and read the comments on anything on KK's Priest, especially I think when the album was announced,
yeah,
it was like the son of the Sentinel and just pick a Priest song, and then the daughter of, you well, know, Devil's Child's daughter.
Yeah. I mean, they say that a lot of times about Shanker too, right? And it's just kind of like, well, yeah, it sounds like something else I did because I wrote that too. So I can see that, you know, KK's been writing stuff for a long time and he's probably got into this certain groove that he likes, and yeah, the stuff
was it a pretty,
sound like it.
When it came to the Priest songs, pretty predictable list you would have thought, or did they pick anything that you went, oh.
What was it? There was one.
Did they do Sinner?
Yes.
They did. That's KK's signature
they
tune.
There was something off of, I want to say off of Stay in Class. There was a deeper one that even Nikki was like, oh my God, they're playing this. Like, I never heard this live. It was like, holy, like, and we've seen Priest a lot. And yeah, I can't remember which one it was, but she even did like the rare, rather than just taking pictures for me, she took a video of that. She's like, I can't believe that they're playing this. So yeah, they did some offbeat stuff too, but that was a great show.
Did you do a Victim of Changes? I was going to ask you, how did Ripper sound singing that? Because that's really the one where that I think sets the bar when it comes to Priest stuff, especially the end of it.
Yeah, I think they did actually do that. Yeah.
Did they do anything off Jugulator or
off,
Demolition?
Off Detonator, nothing off Jugulator, no.
Nothing?
No.
Ah, fuck.
And that's been a comment right along of why? Why not? Do some other.
Because the other guys aren't going to do it. And right. I've been jumping up and down for years saying, do one of the songs.
Yeah.
And here you have the singer and one of the guitar players and they ignore that era at Priest.
Yeah.
Ah, come on. That's a cop. That, to me, that's a bit of a cop out.
But it's, it was a really, really good show.
Yeah. Like,
it's a weird venue.
Where was it? Near Fenway?
It was, starts with a W. Wilbur.
Okay.
It's not the Wilbur.
Theater. An old style theater, is it?
Yeah. Yeah. So like almost like that like old style like UK type of theater, you know what I mean? A little floor and you look over and there's like a giant balcony kind of going up, right? That's what it, you know. So and then the side little mezzanines, which is where we were.
Right. Sold out?
It wasn't sold out. And it was interesting because I was looking to see like how some of the other ones were doing. So in Europe, they have like a lot of sellouts, but here they didn't.
The Tupelo one up the road here was sold out.
Yeah.
It was sold out probably a month or maybe even longer before.
Well, Wilbur's
the show.
Is a bigger venue than Tupelo.
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
But it's got that, in a way, it's got a similar thing of Tupelo in that on the floor there's tables. And you basically have to like turn sideways to watch the show.
I always thought that was fucking odd. And I've seen it at venues. We went to Glenn Hughes, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
Well,
they had the round tables as well. And you're facing one wall.
Yeah.
The fucking band is like, you know, 45 degrees.
Fortunately, we were on the side for that. So we were able to like look pretty decent. We didn't have to like do some weird ass shit to do it.
But, yeah. So, you know, if there's eight seats at the table, probably two of them are, you have a good view of the stage without actually turning your head.
No, not really. Because she'd bought two seats on the floor that were pretty close. And then she bought those fronts. And I was like, you're not going to be happy down there. I said, for one, you're going to be having to turn sideways. And as soon as they stand up, you're dead in the water. You're not going to be able to see.
Yeah.
And so afterwards, she was like, she looked down and she was like, I'm glad we picked these ones up here. But I do know that we met this dude going in. We parked like on Washington. And so we were walking over there and I was like, how the hell do I get to the Wilbur from here? And then we saw this dude on the corner and he had a concert shirt on. And I'm like, he's going to the show. And so we walked up and he was like from like Chicago. And I'm like, what are you doing at this show? And he's like, oh, he goes, I'm like, I'm in town for business. He goes, and I heard the show was here. He goes, and I saw this show, the prior leg of the tour. It was awesome. So he goes, I got nothing else to do tonight. So I bought tickets. So I was like, oh, cool. And so I was like, oh, he goes, you know where it is? I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty sure. I'm like, we got to go down over here. I'm like, just follow me. Yeah, it's like, I don't know exactly where it is, but I know roughly where it is from here. So let's go. Oh, okay, cool. And he was saying that the show he went to, the prior leg was in Chicago, was sold out. He said it was awesome.
Mm.
So
I'm glad they're playing here. It's good. Whatever promoter booked that tour, smart decision.
Yeah,
I know they played theaters, but none of them would really sell out a theater on their own.
Yeah.
So, you know, hook them up and
It was, I think the other thing too that was, is that there were other shows going on down there as well. So I don't know what other bands were playing, but when we were walking out, yeah, there was other stuff that was loading out in other theaters and stuff. So there might have been some competition for tickets at that point. And I think something was at the Orpheum too. So I think there was a lot going on.
There's always competition for tickets. Everybody's playing shows.
So it was crazy.
Yeah.
And then we did have, had some of the best after concert pizza. That was, we get out and it was
soak
like,
up the alcohol.
It was like, no, we, I had like, I had, a, I think I had a beer. That's it. I had one beer.
Okay.
But yeah, afterwards it was like, yeah, hungry. Yeah, I'm hungry. And there was this, there was like a pizza place there and they had huge slices. And we, it was really good though. It was really, really good.
Nice.
It was always a good way to top the concert night off with something, something decent. But yeah, it was, like I said, it was a good show. Like I said, Wilbur is weird. It's a weird venue for shows. Although where we were, it was pretty good because it was, you know, with the little side stage, like little pods, as soon as like KK or Ripper got up in there, that was basically, they came up to like our face level. And so, yeah, they were, it was, they were pretty nice, close seats.
Good. Good. Nice.
Yeah. It was a good time.
Good. So we'll end this one.
Awesome. And before we get out of here, since we mentioned it kind of earlier in the episode, if you want to listen to the interview we did years ago with Jack Russell, you can find that up at focusonmetalpod.com and either search for Jack Russell, Great White, or just go right to episode 321 from back in 2017. You can also find an interview with Tony Montana on episode 420. We had Michael Lardy on as a guest in episode 537 and also episode 538, big long interview with Michael Lardy. And then we also had two appearances from Mark Kendall, and those were on episode 493 and then very recently on episode 562. So lots of Great White content to be found at focusonmetalpod.com. And sadly, of course, we will be retiring our Jack Russell Focus on Metal bumper as of this episode. And rest in peace, Jack. Great guest, great friend of the show, and you'll definitely be missed. All right. That is it for this week. Stick a fork in it. This puppy is done. So for myself and
Richie,
have yourselves a great metal week. And until we talk to you again next time, as always, remember,
focus on metal.
Everything else is insignificant.
Still here? It's over. Go home.